Through these passages, we learn that the harm engendered by this joy comes not only from the wicked and perverse use of God's graces, as in the case of Balaam and those who deceived the people with their miracles, but even from performing them without God's grace, as in those who prophesied their fancies and spoke of visions manufactured by themselves or the devil. When the devil observes their attachment to these wonders, he opens a wide field and provides ample material for their endeavors and meddles extensively. And these individuals with such means spread wide their sails, become shamelessly audacious and abound in prodigious works. And this is not all. The joy and covetousness they have in these works reaches such a point that if previously their pact with the devil was secret, for often the works are performed through a secret pact, now through their boldness they make an express and open one with him, and by an agreement subject themselves to him as his disciples and friends. Hence we have wizards, enchanters, magicians, soothsayers, and witches. Joy in these works goes so far that some, as Simon Magus, not merely want to buy the gifts and graces with money, Acts 18:18, for the service of the devil, but they even try to get hold of sacred and divine objects, which cannot be mentioned without trembling, as has already been witnessed in the theft of the most sacred body of our Lord Jesus Christ, for evil practices and abominations. May God extend and show forth his infinite mercy in this matter. Everyone can readily understand how pernicious these individuals are and how detrimental to Christianity. It should be noted that all those magicians and soothsayers who lived among the children of Israel and were expelled from the land by Saul had fallen into so many abominations and delusions because of their desire to imitate the genuine prophets. Anyone then who has this supernatural gift should not desire nor rejoice in its use, nor should he care about exercising it. God, who grants the grace supernaturally for the utility of the church or its members, who also move him supernaturally as to the matter and time in which he should use it. Since the Lord commanded his disciples not to be anxious about what or how to speak, because it was supernatural matter of faith, and since these works are also a supernatural matter, he will want a man to wait until he becomes the worker by moving the heart toward the practice of the work. Matthew 10:19. For it is by the power of God that every other power should be exercised. In the Acts of the Apostles, the disciples beseeched him in prayer to extend his hand for the work of signs and cures, that the faith of our Lord Jesus Christ would be introduced into hearts. Acts 4:29. The second harm proceeds from the first. It is a twofold detriment to the faith. First, in regard to others. When a person tries to increase these prodigies and powers outside the proper time and without necessity, it can happen that besides tempting God, which is a serious sin, he will be unsuccessful and thereby engender in hearts a distrust and contempt of the faith. Sometimes one is successful because God wishes it for other reasons and motives, as with Saul's sorceries. If Samuel really appeared there, 1 Kings 28:7, yet this will not be always so, but when a person does succeed, he errs and is culpable for using these graces inappropriately. Second, there is detriment to the individual himself in the merit of faith. By giving importance to these miracles, one loses the support of the substantial habit of faith, which is an obscure habit. Where signs and testimonies abound, there is less merit in believing. Saint Gregory declares that faith is without merit when it has proof from human reason. God never works these marvels except when they are necessary for believing, lest his disciples should go without merit by having sensible proof of his resurrection. He did many things to further their belief before they saw him. Mary Magdalene was first shown the empty sepulchre. Afterward, the angels told her about the resurrection, so that she would believe before seeing. As St. Paul says, faith comes through hearing, Romans 10:17. And though she beheld him, he seemed only an ordinary man, that by the warmth of his presence he could finish instructing her in the belief she was lacking, Matthew 28:1-6. And first the women were sent to tell the disciples. Then these disciples set out to see the sepulchre, and journeying incognito to Emmaus with two of his followers, he inflamed their hearts in faith before allowing them to see, Luke 24:15. Finally, he reproved all his disciples for refusing to believe those who had told them of his resurrection, and announcing to St. Thomas that they are blessed who believe without seeing. He reprimanded him for desiring to see and touch his wounds, John 20:25. It is not God's desire that miracles be performed. When he works them, he does so out of necessity. He consequently reprimanded the Pharisees because they were unwilling to believe without signs. If you do not see signs and wonders, you do not believe. John 4:48. Those then who love to rejoice in these supernatural works suffer a great loss in faith. Third, through joy in these works, one ordinarily falls into vainglory or some kind of vanity. Even the very joy in these marvels that is not wholly in and for God is vanity. Our Lord's reproval of the disciples for having rejoiced that the devils were subject to them is a demonstration of this truth. If this joy were not vain, he would not have made the reprimand, Luke 10:20. Chapter 32 of Book 3. Besides the advantage of being freed from these kinds of harm, the soul acquires two excellent benefits. The first refers to the praise and the extolling of God, the second to the exaltation of the soul itself. God is exalted in the soul in two ways. First, the heart and the joy of the will are withdrawn from all that is not God and concentrated upon him alone. David intended this in the verse we quoted at the beginning of the night of this faculty. The heart of man will reach high, and God will be exalted. By lifting the heart above all things, the soul is exalted above them all. And because the soul in this way concentrates only upon God, God receives praise and extolment in manifesting to it his excellence and grandeur. In this elevation of joy in him, God gives testimony of who he is. This is only done when the will is empty of joy and comfort in all things. And he also declares through David, "Leave all and see that I am God," Psalm 45. And again David says, "In a desert way, dry and pathless, I appeared before you to see your power and glory," Psalm 62. God is truly extolled when joy is withdrawn from all things and centered upon him, but he receives much more glory when it is removed from these more marvelous goods and applied to him alone, since by being supernatural they are of a higher entity. To leave them behind for the sake of joy in God alone is to attribute greater glory and excellence to God than to them. Commensurate with the quality and the number of things despised for the sake of another person is the esteem and praise given to that person. Moreover, through the withdrawal of the will from these works, God is exalted in the second manner. The more faith and service rendered to God without testimonies and signs, the more extolled he receives from the soul, since it believes more of him than what the signs and miracles can teach. The second benefit, the exaltation of the soul, owes its origin to the withdrawal of the will from the apparent testimonies and signs. Because of this, the soul is exalted in purest faith, which God then infuses and augments much more abundantly. And together with this, the other two theological virtues, charity and hope, receive increase. As a result, the soul enjoys divine and lofty knowledge by means of the dark and naked habit of faith, and the admirable delight of love through charity, by which it rejoices in no one other than the living God, and satisfaction in the memory by means of hope. All of this is a splendid benefit, essentially and directly required for the perfect union of the soul with God. Chapter 33 of Book 3. Our intention in this work is to guide the soul through spiritual goods to the divine union with God. Now that we are about to discuss this sixth kind, those very good that are the most helpful in this matter, both the reader and I myself will have to pay particular attention. Because of their lack of knowledge, it is a common and certain occurrence with some to let spiritual things serve only for the senses and to leave the spirit empty. Hardly will anyone be found in whom sensory satisfaction does not in some way spoil a good part of what was destined for the spirit, for senses drink up the waters before they reach the spirit, and thus leave the spirit dry and empty. To come then to our subject, I refer by spiritual goods to all those that are an aid and motivating force in turning the soul to divine things and to converse with God, as well as to help in God's communications to the soul. According to their main headings, we can divide spiritual goods into two classes, the delightful and the painful. Each of these can, again, be divided into two kinds. The delightful comprise good that are clearly and distinctly understood, and others that do not afford clear and distinct understanding. The painful likewise include those that are clear and distinct, and others that are vague and obscure. We can also divide these goods according to the faculties of the soul. Those dealing with knowledge are pertinent to the intellect. Those referring to affections belong to the will. Others, in so far as they are imaginary, pertain to the memory. We will discuss the painful goods afterward because they belong to the passive night. The discussion of the vague and distinct delightful goods will be left for the end, since they are pertinent to the general, vague, loving knowledge in which union with God is effected. In the second book, we also deferred this to the end, when we listed the divisions of intellectual apprehensions. Here we shall treat the delightful goods that are clear and distinct. Chapter 34 of Book 3. We would have had to cover a great deal of matter here to instruct the will about the proper conduct concerning joy in the multitudinous apprehensions of the intellect and memory, if we had not amply discussed these apprehensions in the second and third book. Since we indicated there the conduct suitable for these two faculties in this kind of apprehension, there is no necessity for repetition here. The conduct of the will should be the same in their regard. It is sufficient to remark that wherever instructions are given about emptying these faculties of certain apprehensions, the will too, it is understood, should be voided of joy in them. And the conduct required of the memory and intellect concerning these apprehensions is also necessary for the will. Since the intellect and other faculties cannot admit or deny anything without the intervention of the will, the same doctrine that serves for the one faculty would evidently apply to the others also. The reader will also find in those sections what is required here, for the soul will fall into all those kinds of harm if it is ignorant of how to direct to God its joy in these apprehensions. Chapter 35 of Book 3. All goods giving distinct joy to the will can be reduced to four kinds: motivating, provocative, directive, and perfective. We shall discuss them in due order, beginning with motivating goods. Statues, paintings of saints, oratories, and ceremonies. There can be considerable vain joy in relation to statues and paintings. Although they are vital to the divine cult and necessary to move the will to devotion, as the approbation and use of our Holy Mother, the Church, demonstrates, we should always take advantage of them in order to be awakened from our lukewarmness. Many rejoice more in the painting and ornamentation than in the object represented. The Church established the use of statues for two principal reasons: the reverence given to the saints through them, and the motivation of the will, and the awakening of devotion to the saints by their means. In so far as they serve this purpose, their use is profitable and necessary. We should consequently choose those statutes that are more lifelike and move the will more to devotion. Our concentration should be centered upon this devotion more than upon the elaborateness of the workmanship and its ornamentation. There are, as I say, some people who pay more attention to the decorations and the value of the statue than to the object represented, and the interior devotion which they should direct spiritually toward the invisible saint is immediate forgetfulness of the statue, since the purpose of the statue is to give motivation, is so taken up with their exterior elaboration and ornamentation that the senses receive the satisfaction and delight, and then both the love and joy of the will dwell upon that satisfaction. This is a total obstacle to authentic spirituality, which demands the annihilation of the affections in all particular things. Such an attitude is obvious in the abominable custom some have in these times of ours. Without any repugnance for vain worldly fashions, they adorn statues with the jewelry conceited people in the course of time invent to satisfy themselves in their pastimes and vanities. Such an attitude is obvious in the abominable custom of some in these in our times. Without any repugnance for vain worldly fashions, they adorn statues with the jewelry conceited people in the course of time invent to satisfy themselves in their pastimes and vanities, and they clothe the statues in garments that would be reprehensible if worn by themselves. A practice that was and still is abhorrent to the saints represented by their statues. In company with the devil, they strive to canonize their vanities, not without serious offense to the saints. By this usage, the authentic and sincere devotion of the soul, which in itself uproots and rejects every vanity and trace of it, is reduced to little more than doll dressing. Some use the statues for nothing more than idols upon which they center their joy. You will see some who never tire of adding statue upon statue to their collection, of insisting that they be of this particular kind and workmanship, and placed in a certain niche and in a special way. Also, that these statues will give delight to the senses. As for devotion of heart, there is very little. They are so attached, as were Micah and Laban, to their idols. For Micah left his house shouting because they were stolen, and Laban, after a long journey and being enraged, turned over all of Jacob's household furnishings in search for them. Judges 18:23-24. The truly devout person directs his devotion mainly to the invisible object represented, has little need for many statues, and uses those that are conformed more to the divine traits than to human ones. He brings these images and himself through them into conformity with the fashion and condition of the other world, not with this one. He does this so that worldly images will not be stirring his appetite, and so that he will not even be reminded of the world, as he would in having before his eyes any object apparently a part of this world. His heart is not attached to these goods, and if they are taken away, his grief is slight. He seeks the living image of Christ crucified within himself, and thereby he is pleased rather to have everything taken from him and to be left with nothing.